Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. So what now? President Trump is meeting with lawmakers on Capitol Hill after hammering his case last night that he will not agree to reopen the government without a border wall. Senator John Tester, Democrat of Montana, joins us now. Senator, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
So the president made his case for the wall. The Democrats made their case against it. Not a whole lot new from either side. Where does this go now?
Well, first of all, I just want to say something about the president's speech, and that is if you hadn't been paying attention to what's been going on, you wouldn't have known this was about the wall by the president's remarks. I mean, he talked about everything for the first three quarters of that speech except the wall. And I think that's significant because the wall is the biggest increase amount. He wants $5.7 billion. He originally requested $1.6. And by the way, the Appropriations Committee in the Senate agreed to that $1.6 billion. But that aside, I think where we go from here is hopefully we can reopen the government while we negotiate on something that makes sense for border security for the southern border. The challenges with a wall are obvious in that the threats tend to change, and I think we need some analysis done on what the best way is to move forward. I think what we're dealing with right here, Jeremy, is a campaign promise that now the president feels like he has to build, whether it's the best for security for this country or not.
Well, what do you think about a wall? The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called it immoral. Do you think that there's just something inherently wrong with any funding for any kind of wall, or would you be okay with some?
Well, look, I think there's over 600 miles of wall on the border right now. And I think there are some places where a wall does make sense. I will tell you unequivocally, a wall from sea to signing sea is not the right direction to go. A wall that we spend $24 to $32 million per mile, I think we can do much cheaper with technology and manpower and make the southern border much safer. I think we consider all the possibilities that are out there to make sure that our borders are secure. I think we address issues like the visa overstay, which is why we have so many undocumented folks in this country to begin with, and talk about common sense ideas to secure the border and make sure that that border remains secure.
Your state of Montana went for President Trump by 20 percentage points in 2016. What do you tell people there? I'm sure that you have a lot of constituents, maybe even people who voted for you and him, who want the wall.
Well, I think one thing that Montanans all agree on, whether you're Republican or Democrat, is they want money spent appropriately. And I think that's the challenge here. We have not been given any analysis on what the best thing to do for security for the southern border. And I think that most Montanans would say, you know what, a wall to sea to shining sea is not something that can work and work effectively. And I really believe that Montanans, there are some that want to build a wall, and there's no doubt about it. But there is a vast majority that think that we can do better by using other options that are much more cost effective.
We've seen some stories about some cracks forming in the Republican Party in the Senate, that some Republicans are coming over to the Democrat side and say, let's open at least most of the government while we figure this out. Do you see that yourself?
Well, I think this government shutdown is ridiculous, and I think the thinking Republicans out there are saying this is truly ridiculous. Let's open the government. What we've created here, Jeremy, truthfully, with this government shutdown, is I think we've allowed the bad guys to look at us from a different standpoint. Customs and Border Protection, TSA, they're all working without pay. That is not good for our national security overall. I think there's a lot of Republicans that are saying enough is enough. Let's open the government and then let's negotiate about the right direction to go to make sure that the borders are truly secure.
Do you think the government will be reopened by the time the State of the Union happens later this month?
I can't predict. I can tell you that the president wanted this shutdown. He talked about it for, I think he mentioned it 25 times that he wanted a government shutdown. I think it's ridiculous. This is the third time in basically the last year we've had a government shutdown while he's been president. I don't think it helps. I don't think it makes government more efficient. I think it wastes taxpayer dollars. It should end today as far as I'm concerned.
I want to ask you about one more thing while we have you. The freshman House Democrat, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's gotten a lot of attention, has talked in recent days about a policy that would increase the top tax rate to 60% or 70% for the very wealthy. We've had that in the past, but not recently. What do you think about that idea?
Whether her proposal is the right idea, I don't know, because this is the first time I've heard about it with you, Jeremy. But I do know that we cannot continue to run negative budgets in this country that increase the debt. We need to deal with the debt issue. I think it's a big thing, and you do it by two ways. You cut expenditures or increase income. And so I don't know her bill. I haven't seen her bill. But in the meantime, I think that we need to look at both programs that have outlived their usefulness and reduce those programs and take a look at the tax code to eliminate loopholes in particular and move forward. But look, ideas are great. The challenge is we need to debate them, and then we need to vote on them. And oftentimes around here, we don't debate or vote on them.
In fairness, I don't think she has a bill yet. I think it's just a 60 Minutes interview at this point, but we'll see comes. Senator John Tester, Democrat of Montana, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you very much.
Well, over on Wall Street, technology stocks have been at the center of the recent turmoil. Slowing demand for iPhones in China and a trade war have triggered sharp declines at some of the country's biggest companies. But the tech industry is facing another problem: dissatisfied workers. Labor organizing has never been a big part of Silicon Valley's well-compensated startup culture. But as businesses like Apple, Facebook, Netflix grow into massive multinational corporations, they're confronting the challenge of keeping their workers happy. Sam Harnett from member station KQED reports.
Stand up! Fight back!
Last fall, something unprecedented happened at Google's headquarters. Employees walked out in protest, and an estimated 20,000 workers at Google campuses around the world joined in.
Stand up! Fight back!
Protesters' concerns range from Google's work with the U.S. military on drone technology to a lack of diversity at the company. But there was one issue at the core: power. Workers didn't feel like Google gave them the power that it promised when it hired them. At the protest, CEO Neil Hart demanded that the company put an employee on its board.
When we put our Noogler hats on, you told us to have an owner's mindset. You told us you aren't just employees, you are owners. And the owners say, time's up!
Noogler hats are given to Google employees when they're first hired. They are multicolored caps with little propellers. These hats embody the start-uppy vibe of Google's past. But today, the company has over 85,000 full-time employees, and it's close to joining Amazon and Apple as America's only trillion-dollar corporations.
Time is up! Time is up! Time is up!
Organizing in Silicon Valley didn't start with these tech employees. The industry's shadow workforce, the independent contractors, they provided the spark. And there are a lot of them, tens of thousands. At Google, they make up half the staff. They do everything from cook to code, but they don't get the high salaries or perks like free lunches and childcare. In 2015, the contractors began organizing under a group called Silicon Valley Rising. They did things like get higher pay and unions for some bus drivers, and they drew attention from Bay Area media.
Union supporters of drivers who shuttle around Apple employees are protesting outside the tech giant's Cupertino headquarters this morning.
But it wasn't until Donald Trump's election in 2016 that full-time tech employees began organizing in earnest. A group called the Tech Workers Coalition emerged. It complements Silicon Valley Rising. It has members of all types, from contractors to full-time programmers. Google employee Stephanie Parker is active in the coalition.
One of the first things I noticed when I came to the Bay Area and started working in the tech industry was the blatant discrimination and basically a class system. How the differences in how people were treated were along the same old lines of race, class, and gender that you see in any other industry, and even more stratified here.
As a woman of color working in the tech industry, Parker says she's often felt alone.
My story of feeling isolated and feeling like no one else understands, feeling that my coworkers just want to focus on building tools and building apps and are not worried about these larger issues. I feel like that story is present in so many tech workplaces.
Over the last year, workers at different tech companies have protested openly. At Microsoft, they spoke out against the company's work with immigration and customs enforcement. At Amazon, they criticized the company for providing facial recognition software to police departments. And at Salesforce, they held a rally against the company's work with customs and border protection. Stephanie Parker came and spoke.
Me and a couple of my friends put this together, and we're hoping to send a message to Salesforce, to the tech companies, that tech won't build it and they should cancel the contract.
Tech executives like CEO Sundar Pichai of Google say they are responding to workers' concerns. Here he is talking to the New York Times about the Google walkout, which the company eventually supported publicly.
Moments like this show that we didn't always get it right, and so we are committed to doing better. We are listening to employees. That's partly why today is important.
But some workers say they're scared of speaking up. Silicon Valley companies make them sign non-disclosure agreements and discourage them from talking to the press.
As we start to grow and as we get stronger, it'll be easier for people to stand up and to be more public about this.
This programmer is active in the Tech Workers Coalition, but he doesn't want to use his real name for fear of losing his job.
But for the time being, we have to carve out a way to take action that still protects us.
Companies like Google, Amazon, and Facebook threw money at traditional conflicts with labor around pay and benefits. They've been able to pay high salaries, pamper workers with free meals, childcare, and even laundry services. But tech companies don't do this for all of their workers, and that's what spurred initial tech organizing efforts in Silicon Valley that have been growing over the last decade. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Harnett.
Today in the Oval Office, President Trump spoke about ongoing negotiations with Democrats to fund the border wall at the center of the shutdown, now in its 19th day. And he said his trigger for declaring a national emergency at the border, which would allow him to sidestep Congress and use Department of Defense funds to build his wall, is not getting a deal with Democrats.
We're all working together. I really believe the Democrats and the Republicans are working together. I think that something will happen, I hope. Otherwise, we'll go about it in a different manner. And I don't think we'll have to do that, but you never know.
Let's bring on our political strategist, Republican Alice Stewart. Hi, Alice.
Hi. Great to be with you, Jeremy.
Great to have you. And Democrat Jamal Simmons, host on Hill TV. Hi, Jamal.
Hello. Good to be with you.
So Friday is the day that this shutdown is probably going to become the longest in U.S. history. It's also the first time that there would be a paycheck going out that is not going to go out. A lot of these workers have been working, we've been saying, without the promise of a paycheck, but Friday, it'll get real. Jamal, is that going to change the whole dynamic when these workers actually don't get their paychecks and maybe TSA workers just, you know, do the airports shut down? Is that going to just change the whole thing?
I think it will change the whole thing. I was in the airport, recently, and I thanked TSA workers for working for free. They rolled their eyes at me. They were so annoyed. I think that this is, it does get real for people. Look, maybe you can make it past one check. You can not pay a bill. I mean, those of us not Donald Trump have experienced some of this before. But once you get past this first check and you start having to deal with a second month of expenses and you got tuition or you got gas money or you've got just all the things, you know, a little bit of a credit card minimum here or a heating bill there, it starts to get very dicey very quickly. And we assume a lot of these people don't already have a lot of space in their budget. So the president is really courting a disaster for families.
Well, how much of a disaster is this going to be ultimately? Alice, I want to ask you about something we heard last night on Fox News. This was South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham. He praised the president for his speech last night. Today he spoke in the Oval Office at a bill signing, but last night, of course, he used the Oval Office to make his case for the wall. And afterwards, this is what Lindsey Graham said. He said, it's the best chance he's seen to get border security, maybe some immigration reform done, and then this.
The only way we lose is to give in. If we'll stand firm, put deals on the table that make sense, we will win this on behalf of the American people. But if we undercut the president, that's the end of his presidency and the end of our party, and we deserve to be punished if we give in now.
The end of the presidency and the Republican Party. How did a president with a loose handle on the truth and a wall become the determining factor over whether your party, the party of Lincoln, lasts?
Rob, I don't see the end of the presidency or the party if this wall does not get built. And that is, in my view, an inflammatory statement
but
to
he
try and
if he
really
believes
make
it,
the case.
If he believes it, doesn't that mean there's no negotiation?
I hope not. Yeah. And look, the president is right to continue to make the case for his wall because he was elected in large part because of that. I personally mm-hmm. never believed Mexico was going to pay for it, but I did believe he was going to stand firm on border security. But campaigning is one thing. Governing is much more difficult. And he is becoming aware of that every day. And certainly every day this shutdown continues. And both sides last night were able to make their case yet again. Nothing new came out. He was able to make his case that this is a humanitarian crisis and the border is a pipeline for drugs and sexual assault victims and sex trafficking. And Pelosi and Schumer were able to say that this was misinformation and a manufactured crisis. They both got their information out there yet again. But now's the time for them both sides to come together, roll up their sleeves and start the hard work of negotiating. Should have been done 2 years ago, but now's the time even more so to get it done.
Well, Jamal, what about on the Democratic side? We talked to John Tester, the senator from Montana today, who said, look, there are hundreds of miles of border fencing already. What is the big deal about adding another $5 billion or even $3 billion, which some Republicans are now saying they would accept, for border wall just to get this thing over with?
You know, it's interesting that this both sides-ism, I reject it because the Democrats are not really appealing to their base. President Donald Trump is trying to look out for about 30, maybe 35% of the American population. The Democrats are on the side of about 60% of people, according to the polls. And let's just say this for real. The Democrats have been willing to pass and passing Republican bills in order to fund places like the TSA, the Border Patrol, the FBI, law enforcement agencies that, frankly, the Democratic base is not so excited about funding law enforcement agencies in the Department of Defense. So the Democrats are trying to do this as broadly as possible. If the president wants to build a wall, I think Pelosi should say, sure. The speaker should say, sure, if you build it in Canada, because there are a lot more terrorists that have come across the border from Canada than there have been from Mexico.
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing. Some have accused President Trump of using the Oval Office inappropriately for spreading misinformation. I mean, the fact checkers are having a field day today with a lot of the claims that he made that are not true. On the other hand, you know, there are tweets comparing Schumer and Pelosi to the American Gothic painting of the farmer with the pitchfork and his wife. They looked so wooden. I mean, just both of you, you're strategists. What would you tell everybody about how they're, you know, how they're putting their messages out?
I would say let's replay last night and do it on radio because neither one of them came across right in a positive light optically. Look, the president shines when he is at a rally. He's feeding off the crowd and they're cheering him on and he's able to use his body language. When he's at the desk, while that is a very presidential setting, it's not his strength.
Well,
his
at least we didn't have any water bottle moments last night.
Exactly, exactly. And then you have Chuck and Nancy, the Schumer and Pelosi, crowded behind the podium. It was just not a very strong optic. But the overall message takeaway was that they both, again, were able to make their case with regard to border security. And it's time really to stop talking about Trump's wall and let's talk about the broader conversation of border security. And both were able to do that.
Okay.
I watched I watched the both speeches from end to end. My wife, however, chose to go upstairs and watch something completely different. I think I know as much about – she knows as much about what occurred as I do, not having watched it.
You know,
you can
learn just as much by reading the transcript afterwards.
Which is almost nothing because there's nothing that was said last night that was different than what had been said before. Yeah. So I don't know that anybody who chose not to watch it lost anything.
And one other quick takeaway real quickly, Jeremy, that may have hurt the president more than anything – and like I said, I supported what he said, but you tweeted something earlier that the ratings of Chuck and Nancy were higher than the president's
time.
Must
have
so
made
that
him
had
really
to be more devastating
upset
than anything else from last night.
There is news I want to get to that lawyers for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort accidentally revealed in poorly redacted court filings yesterday that Manafort shared campaign polling data with a Russian businessman that the special counsel has identified as a former Russian intelligence officer. Alice, is that collusion?
It certainly sounds that way. And this is serious. And for people that don't know, Jamal's very aware of this. Polling data is not just Trump is ahead by 50 points and Hillary is at 40. Polling data is a lot more than that. It contains analytics and data and pulling information that really can shape the message, where you message, how you message, who you message to. And that is critical information that could have been certainly put in the hands of Russians. And not to mention the fact we also learned, you know, having discussions about a pro-Russia peace plan. So a lot of this information is extremely disturbing. But the polling data, there's a lot of information. And having been on campaigns, that is closely guarded. Oftentimes you have to check it out. And it doesn't get taken away from the campaign headquarters without everyone's knowledge.
And Jamal, generally, I'm assuming that you think it was collusion as well. I mean, giving something to a Russian, that's kind of what collusion is. But I want to ask you about the reporting today that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is expected to resign in a few weeks once the new Attorney General William Barr is confirmed. Remember, there were all sorts of reports that he was going to be fired by Trump because he's been overseeing Mueller's Russia investigation. We've known for a while he was going to step aside. But today, Senator Lindsey Graham told reporters that William Barr said he would allow Mueller's investigation to finish up. Do you have a sense that him saying that, with Rosenstein stepping aside, might be an issue in his confirmation hearings? And what faith do you have that the Mueller investigation will continue if Rosenstein steps aside?
Well, I don't have a lot of faith in anything Lindsey Graham says, because it seems like one day he's, you know, headed in one direction and the next day he's headed in another. It's hard to know. Maybe this means that Mueller is wrapping up, and by the time Rosenstein is ready to resign, we will have already had the report. But I got to tell you, the one thing that seems clear to me is that they got him. I've been reluctant to say this before. You know, I've been thinking, well, maybe the president did this, and maybe there's that.
You mean with the
Manafort?
But
they got him.
You mean
the Manafort information certainly says to me that I think they've got him. And maybe what's happened is, as people come into the Justice Department thinking they know the answer to this and they're willing to be a Trump stooge, they're confronted with the evidence and the data, and they decide, you know what, I don't want to touch this hot potato. Let me let Mueller finish, and hopefully that's where Attorney General Barr will be.
I just want to leave us with a line from Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota Democratic senator, who's thinking about a presidential run, but she tweeted out a video listing things that Trump didn't talk about last night. Here she is.
And he didn't talk about the fact that the Chinese landed a craft on the moon while his government was shutting down NASA. That's just wrong.
I just think that's an interesting point. You know, think about all the things that aren't happening right
the
now.
The things that are not happening.
Right.
You're not landing on the moon, people.
Alice Stewart.
We only had 8 minutes.
Republican political strategist Jamal Simmons, Democrat. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
People with Samsung smartphones are discovering it's not so easy to get off Facebook. Some users of the Android-based platform have complained that they can't delete the pre-installed Facebook app from their phones. They can only disable it. For more, we're joined by Callum Borchers, senior innovation reporter at WBUR. Hi, Callum.
Hi, Jeremy.
So some Samsung phones come with the Facebook app pre-installed, but users are learning they can't delete or uninstall it. Is this true for every Samsung user? And is it only the Facebook app with this restriction?
Well, it's not true for every model of Samsung phone, but there isn't a convenient list for consumers. So if you want to know before you buy, you might have to ask a customer service rep in the store, maybe scour online message boards. And a pre-installed app like this, it's a business deal between the software maker and the phone maker. And so it's not uncommon. It's kind of like a product placement in a movie. So you might get a phone that has YouTube or the Amazon shopping app pre-installed.
But what is the difference between disabling it and uninstalling it? Is Facebook, for example, still able to track users if they disable the app?
Facebook says no. It says there's no meaningful difference between disable and delete. But then again, it's fair to say that public trust in Facebook's word has eroded over the past year. I think it's also worth noting that tracking isn't the only issue here. You know, some people delete Facebook because they think it's become an unhealthy habit for them. And so if you can't actually delete the app, the temptation's always there on your phone.
Right. What have Samsung and Facebook said about this?
Well, so they've emphasized that there's no data collection when the app is disabled, as I mentioned. And Facebook also says that the pre-installed app is a convenience. It's meant to give users the best experience right out of the box, so sort of save you time setting up your new device.
So Facebook has been trying to reassure billions of users and keep people from leaving after a slew of bad headlines. And we've talked about all of them, privacy and political activity, et cetera. How many people are actually quitting Facebook right now?
Well, Facebook's latest financial report shows the number of daily active users in the U.S. and Canada has been flat since the third quarter of 2017. Mm-hmm. So that's not great, but it's also not disastrous. But more worrisome for the company is a Pew Research Center survey published in the fall. That found that about a quarter of American adults who had Facebook on their smartphones have deleted the app. Mm-hmm. And the worst news for Facebook is that the deletion rate is much higher for people under 30. It's 44%. So, you know, it's possible some people maybe exaggerate in a survey. But what could be going on here is that people aren't deactivating their accounts, but maybe they're just checking once or twice a day on the computer, and then they're not checking anymore on their phones.
Yeah, and they're probably saying, screw you, Facebook. I'm going to Instagram, which is owned by Facebook.
Right.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Callum. A bankruptcy judge has given Sears another chance to avoid liquidation. Sears declared bankruptcy in October. The company's CEO, Eddie Lampert, has been fighting to keep a few hundred Sears and Kmart stores open. Now has until 4 p.m. Eastern tomorrow to make a $120 million deposit. Is Sears still alive?
It's on life support, but yes, it's still alive for now. Recall that Sears directors indicated they were going to reject Lampert's $4.4 billion bid, so they're giving him some time to come up with another offer. The alternative here is just to liquidate, right? You sell off as many assets as you can to pay down as much debt as possible, and that could come as soon as the end of this month. But what Lampert's hoping here is that he can salvage about 400 of the best performing stores.
Okay, we will see what happens with Sears. Callum Borchers, senior innovation reporter at WBUR. Thanks, as always.
Always fun to be here.
As DNA testing becomes more sophisticated and cheaper and available, you can pick up a kit at the drugstore. Consumers have new access to all kinds of genetic information, things as insignificant as whether they're likely to sneeze when exposed to sunlight. Yep, there's a gene for that. Or as serious as whether they carry the BRCA genes that increase the risk of breast cancer. And now there's no question that some of that information is having a positive, maybe even life-saving impact on people. But two researchers in California wondered if, in some cases, finding out about one's genetics might have a negative impact. Not just the worry if you knew, for instance, you had a gene like BRCA. But what if knowing you had certain genetic material led to you creating a certain mindset about your capabilities, and then maybe even having a physiological reaction as well, like producing more or less of a certain hormone, for instance? The Stanford researchers set out to test this hypothesis by briefly giving volunteers erroneous, false information about whether they had a gene that limited their ability to exercise or made them more hungry. And what happened next was, well, let's ask them. The study's authors join us. Stanford University psychology professor Aaliyah Crum, welcome.
Thank you.
And your grad student Bradley Turnwald is there as well. Hi, Brad.
Hi.
And Professor, I want to start with you. I mean, we know how many different things genes can do in combination with other factors. But really, there is one that affects your ability to exercise?
There is. There are several genes that have been implicated in suggesting how well we respond to exercise.
Yeah. And this one, I think, had to do with lung capacity or breathing capacity?
Indeed. It has to do with how well we can convert oxygen and carbon dioxide in our bodies.
Well, I want to get to what you did with your 200 volunteers. But, Brad, what were the conversations going into this? As you batted this about, how did you even come to this idea of testing what you tested?
Well, obviously, more and more people are getting genetic risk results, and you can now get them in the privacy of your own home. And prior research has looked at whether there are emotional effects of receiving this information. Are there behavioral effects on people after receiving this information? But we really wanted to know, does merely receiving this information change your actual risk by changing your mindset? And can that even influence the way your body responds?
Yeah, so the mind-body connection. So you gathered 200 volunteers and some baseline data. You had about half of them run on a treadmill. Half were given a meal, because again, we're talking about genes that affect the ability to exercise and whether or not your body knows when it's full. So, Professor, what happened?
We had them come in for a baseline session, which means we had their baseline levels in terms of their gut peptides or their hormones in response to what they ate in the diet study, and also in terms of their oxygen conversion rates in the exercise study. And then we had them come in a week later. Some were told they were at risk. Some were told they were protected.
So you told someone who you knew maybe had a great lung capacity genetically and should do really well on a treadmill, you might have told them that they had genetic material that would have made it harder for them to have exercise capacity.
Exactly. Of the group who had the genetically at risk profile, half were told they were at risk and half were told they were protected. And of the people who were protected, same thing. Half were told they were at risk and half were told they were protected.
Mm-hmm. So, Brad, pick it up there.
So what we saw was that regardless of people's actual genetic risk, what really mattered was what we told them. Across the board, people who we told that they had an increased genetic risk for exercise capacity, they performed worse. And people who we said that they had, they were protected genetically from this poor exercise capacity, they performed at similar levels as their baseline. And so we really saw the power of that information changing their outcomes.
Wow. Professor, what happened with the ability to know when you're full?
The people who were in the diet study, again, we had them consume the exact same meals at baseline and then again after receiving genetic information. And what we found was that when people were told that they were genetically predisposed to feel less full, they felt less full than people who were told they were genetically predisposed to feel more full.
So this isn't just a matter of, it's all in my head, I'm feeling better about that, or, wow, I have a capacity to feel less full, so I'm going to, you know, drink this whole thing because, you know, it wasn't just psychological. You found it was physiological.
Yeah, we were particularly interested in not just the subjective response, how you felt in response to this genetic information, but the body's physiological response. And what we found in this study is that it changed their body's response. So in the diet study, we found that those who were told they were protected, who were going to feel more full, actually physiologically had more of this fullness hormone than those who were told they're at risk.
They produced a hormone.
Correct.
How does that happen?
What we think is going on, and we've seen in a number of different studies in which our mind influences the body, is that there are these direct effects. Your mind is trying to predict what's going to happen. And the brain, being intricately connected to our every system in the body, changes things. It adapts in order to prepare for what it thinks is going to occur next. Mm-hmm. So when the brain thinks, I'm not eating enough, I'm going to feel full, it changes its physiology accordingly.
And how about on the running side, Brad? What physiological change did you see there?
Yeah, so in the running experiment, we had participants hooked up to a mask in which we measured their oxygen and carbon dioxide output in every single breath throughout the course of their running test. And what we found was that people who we told had increased genetic risk, it decreased their lung capacity by about 2 liters of air per minute. So that's just the sheer amount of air that they're moving into and out of their lungs per minute.
Hmm.
And it also decreased their ability to remove toxic carbon dioxide buildup.
Wow, this is amazing. I mean, again, my conclusion would be people shouldn't know when they have a risk because then they're going to produce the risk. Professor, what do you think the takeaway from this is?
The answer isn't really so simple, right? The answer is not, hey, don't get genetic testing, it's going to make you worse. It's, hey, be mindful that receiving genetic risk puts you in a mindset, and that mindset can have an impact on your body as well as how you feel and how you behave.
Do you think you can take this to cancer, for instance? If you know you have some sort of risk for cancer, can you start producing physiological reactions that will lead to cancer or make you more susceptible to cancer?
That's the extreme case of this, and our data in no way suggest that. The data do, however, confer with a lot of other studies showing that, look, our minds are not irrelevant. They matter, and they probably matter in most conditions. We know that they matter a lot when it comes to cardiovascular system, when it comes to the endocrine systems, two systems that we worked with here. Our mindsets, though, don't change tumor size.
Yeah.
Yeah, so whether these results would extend to cancer is obviously a really interesting question. It's a more difficult question to answer for ethical reasons. In our study, we were really careful about the genes and conditions we looked at, what we could ethically measure. And so we did three things to really limit the effect that this could have on participants. One was that we wanted to use a disease such as obesity that people would care about, but it wouldn't be as emotionally impactful as something like cancer. Two, we needed to get results in a short time window so that people were never out of our sight with potentially false information. And three, immediately after we got the last physiological results, we fully debriefed participants on the real nature of the study and talked about, you know, the importance of behavior in determining things like exercise and eating and obesity.
That's key. You just didn't send them off with this false, you know, thinking about their DNA so that maybe they're collapsing on the treadmill. It does feel, though, like, as you said, just be mindful, because information's good, but having it, you know, could your body could adjust to it.
Certainly. And look, and again, we're not saying that you shouldn't receive genetic information. What we're learning about genes is really important, but our genetic makeup is just one piece of the puzzle. Our mindsets are another piece, an often overlooked piece. And this work that Brad and our team at Stanford has done is just the tip of the iceberg in understanding the role of mindsets in genetic information.
And Brad is Brad Turnwald, a graduate student, speaking to us with his professor, Aaliyah Crum. Stanford researchers will link you to their study on the physiological effects of learning DNA results, which was published in the journal Nature Human Behavior. Brad, professor, thank you so much.
Thank you. We appreciate your time and care.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro begins his second term tomorrow, promising 2019 will be a year of fresh starts for Venezuela. But the country is in economic freefall. Shortages of food, medicine, and other necessities have forced millions to flee the country since he took office in 2013. And just this week, the Trump administration announced a new round of sanctions that have targeted Maduro's inner circle. Joining us now is the BBC's Vladimir Hernandez. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
So, first of all, as Maduro prepares for his inauguration tomorrow, what is the situation like as you're hearing in Venezuela right now?
Well, it's not very good. I mean, people are kind of like dismissing the idea that he's swearing himself in after an electoral process that effectively hasn't been recognized by most countries, not only in South America, but around the world. So there's a lot of disbelief of there's going to be more of the same president who is in power and is incredibly unpopular.
And the Secretary of State in the United States, Mike Pompeo, has called tomorrow's swearing-in ceremony a sham inauguration. He told the newspaper in Brazil that things could be done to end Maduro's regime. Does the U.S. have any leverage over Maduro?
Well, there are already sort of Washington-led sanctions in place against some officials in the country, and that's kind of been the main strategy to try to pressure the Venezuelan authorities not to go ahead with the process that began last year, electing a new assembly that effectively appointed Maduro for an extra 6 years. I think Venezuelans will not be surprised that he's swearing himself in. I think it's just more reaffirming the lack of democratic credentials that everyone inside and probably outside of the country are looking at.
And one of the other countries in the region, a big country, is Brazil. And now Maduro is facing pressure from that country and its new leader as well. Brazil says it doesn't recognize his reelection and wants him to step down. What does that say about the politics in the region?
It says a lot. I mean, the main player in South American politics is Brazil. And for years, whilst Lula da Silva was in power, he was a main ally of Hugo Chavez. And a lot of the things that were happening in Venezuela in the last 15 to 17 years, they counted in a way with the political backing of Brazil, with a socialist government there, etc. I think Brazil can become probably a stronger voice. And it's a very influential player because of its economy, because of its size, because of the influence it now currently has with other countries in the world. So, yeah, it could be a determining factor in the rest of this year what Bolsonaro will start doing.
Do you think that Maduro is going to make it through a second 6-year term?
It's a million-dollar question, isn't it? I think the state of the economy would make those probabilities very low. We need to remember that it's a country in hyperinflation. There's talk about 3 million people by the UN is counting about at least 3 million people leaving the country in the last 2 years. That number could go to 5 million people. Mm. A lot of people depending on remittances from whatever country they are abroad. It's a country where child malnutrition is at record levels. The economy has shrunk at least a third. It doesn't look very good for any leader.
Well, and when you say 3 million people in the last few years have left Venezuela, who's left there? It must just be people who can't afford to leave.
It goes by waves. At the beginning, you would see middle classes, more sort of, let's say, educated or well-off sort of people who were, you know, university students or people, young professionals with families or young professionals without families going to other places to say, well, I just want to make something out of my career. When I went there in October, I saw working class people, I met a man who showed me, I've got $25 here in my hand, and this is what I'm going to use to reach Colombia. Mm. And it all seems so hopeless that, yeah, it's not just the middle class or the well-educated. The working class have fled the country en masse as well.
One other person, an important person who has just left the country is a Supreme Court judge who helped Maduro consolidate power in his first term and has now fled to the United States, saying he couldn't criticize Maduro in Venezuela because he feared for his safety. Tell us more about this man and what this says that he has left and fled to the U.S.
It's a well-trodden path of recent officials who have occupied high sort of posts in the Maduro government that have left. He's one of the latest who have gone and left the country seeking safety elsewhere. I think there's two ways of seeing this. A lot of Venezuelans inside the country will give you the cynical view of, well, why didn't you leave before and say something before? Some of the decisions that have led even to the undemocratic credentials of Venezuela happening are partly to the responsibility of this judge who approved some of the legislations that went through that made the whole process happen. On the other hand, obviously, there is that, well, what will he say? What will he tell the US authorities about what is going on with the Maduro regime, which we need to remember, a lot of top officials are being accused of drug trafficking, charges of money laundering, so they are up against it.
Vladimir, you're joining us from London today, but you've been in Caracas in the last few months. What sticks out to you? Is there any sign of hope there in Venezuela?
I'd say no. I'd say the impression you get as soon as you come back is that it's a godforsaken land that people are just struggling to get by. And I keep in touch with my own family there or friends who are still there. And every single story you get every day is just so hopeless and sad. I think the situation where you're in a country where you just don't know where you're going to get your next meal and you go into a supermarket and you see empty shelves, it's just really hopeless.
That is Vladimir Hernandez of the BBC speaking with us from London about the situation in Venezuela. Vladimir, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.